And now there has been some periods in my life personally, I'm talking about my personal experience, when I forgot God and I forgot religion and decided to handle my problems without considering God, you know, and the
So you had the a results time of secularization.
The results were just miserable.
Disastrous.
And on the contrary, there were some situations where I considered God and what he wanted me to do. And what came out for me was the peace, the salvation, and even in some cases. So Asma, I think that's that requires a wide range of answers. There are lots of criteria that have influence on what people feel about certain things. And definitely, at least for me, religion is the thing that makes you feel better in case you make use of a good religion, good advices, and in case you submit yourself to Allah.
Yes, true religion, and submitting yourself to all the rules of that religion.
And in case you do all these, definitely the consequence would be in your favor, I promise you.
Yeah, of course. So, Bita, shall you please tell me your ideas upon
that? Of course. Yeah, the thing is, I think it is not the problem of the religion that people think in this way. The problem is the way people look at their religion, you know. Mm-hmm. We are defining something that as the way we want to do it, you know. Human being is something that wants to be free, mm-hmm, and just wants to fly freely in this world and do whatever they want to do. And for just doing this, they need approval from other people, and just for receiving this approval, they will do anything. And one of these things is defining something in a way that will just make the things they do accepted for other people.
That's very true.
And because of the thing, they're thinking like that religion is something that tells you what to do. Always what to do. Order you to do this, order
you
to do that. Exactly. And this is the point why people just want to resist the fact that religion is not something that will limit you. Mm-hmm. It's something that grow you.
Yeah.
Okay. And because of this point, I think we have to change our way of thinking and way of looking at other things, especially this religion. As you know, people around the world have many different kinds of religions. But, you know, this is not the topic, actually, because in every religion, there are some morals that somehow are common. And because of this point, people are hating to be limited. They want to do sins because, you know, they think that, okay, what is the reason why I have to be limited? So I have to ignore it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bita.
Thank
you for your nice contributions. I actually made use of whatever you said. It was so fruitful. I hope the audience have the same feeling. Thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Back to Reality. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
The Persian language in India.
Part 2.
India, a land with gushing rivers and green forests, and ancient culture and national treasures that harkened back to a time long since past, and which, with history as its witness, has put many a hard time behind it with the help of various cultural attributes like language. India has managed to introduce itself to the world as a country that takes pride in its cultural history. In the first episode, the role of the Persian language and the Persian culture in India was revealed. We saw how Farsi, which took root in India 800 years ago, has managed to achieve many things in the realms of art, culture, poetry and verse, architecture, social dynamics, politics, and economics. The Persian tongue has been an undeniable influence in all this, a language that has been the language of culture, politics, and art for centuries.
India and Iran, they are very unique in terms of, you know, their experiences, in terms of their values and culture, in terms of their paradigm, in terms of their political experiences. This uniqueness basically brings a kind of unity of the two different cultures who have experienced more or less same thing, the same problems, the same kind of exploitation by the external forces. And this experience and this kind of the historical experiences, facing a lot of problems and challenges, that make both the countries very intelligent, wise, hardworking, and forward-looking. And this is what I say, the heritage of both the countries. This is the civilizational heritage of both India and Iran that make them unique in this whole world.
Arshi Khan's comments speak to the deep-rooted relations between Iran and India over centuries, relations that went beyond the day-to-day social contacts and took on a spiritual aspect. The Persian language hasn't acted as a tool to plunder India's natural wealth. Rather, it's been perceived as the reason behind the deep spiritual relations between the two nations. As you saw at the beginning of this study, Farsi turned into a language of poetry, human relations, administration of justice, maintaining law and order, and the development of spiritual thoughts. The thousands of documents written in Farsi are held in Indian libraries and cultural centers. But the Persian language, which was once very much a part of people's lives in India, has been threatened by various elements. As a result, India and the history of the Persian language in this nation have drifted apart. The year 1832, the beginning of Britain's colonization of India, also marks the beginning of the British government's attack on the Persian language. Britain had occupied India with the help of its powerful military and fought with the people, and that way it imposed itself onto India's history. But what prevented Britain from impacting the Indian people's culture was none other than the Persian language with its beauty and richness. But the British launched a deliberate attack on Farsi and weakened it. Now, in the year 2012, I ask language researchers to tell me more about Farsi.
The aim of them, the goal of the British was actually to try to attract the attention of the Indian people, whether it were Hindus, whether it were Muslims, because they would think, look, these people, they are not foreigners, they are not aliens. They come here, they are trying to adopt their own culture. Because, you know, when you speak the language, when you adopt some parts of the culture, the strangeness or even enmity, it actually it reduces or vanishes from there. So this is one of the tricks used by the British. First, to attract the people towards them. Then to follow the policy of divide and rule. Now they try to create the differences between the Hindus and between the Muslims and between the Sunnis and between the Shias. And even among the Hindus themselves, they try to do that. And they realize that since Persian is so much widely spread all over India, the basic factor combining the people of India is Persian, because the Persians, the people of the south, they have their own languages. The people of Kashmir and Punjab and Sindh, and other, they have their own languages. But the lingua franca, the language which they used to converse with each other, was Persian.
The research tells us that one of the obstacles Britain faced in achieving its cultural objectives in India was the Persian language, and so it was targeted. The plan was to eradicate Farsi from Indian lives, and eventually English replaced Farsi in India.
But when the British came, they wanted to, you know, to disturb two, three things, I must tell you. They were not in a position immediately to take militarily India, or military takeover immediately. They did not do this. In the beginning, they basically captured the economic market. So they first approached the economy. So you find the British came as a businessman here in India. Then after economics, they wanted to play politics. And then they, you know, brewed the feud and divide between different kings, etc. And they began to capture some lands, especially the coastal areas like Bombay, like Calcutta, etc., like Madras. So you find that when the British came, they were not comfortable with the Indian tradition. They were not comfortable with the Indian grassroots level administration like panchayat, like janapadas, like Mughal institutions, governing institutions. They were not comfortable with this, because these were not these institutions were not thought to be benefiting the British, because British had their own agenda, and that agenda was to exploit the country, because Mughals were here not to exploit the country. The Sultanate king, the Muslims, were here not to exploit the country.
What history bears witness to is that Britain invaded India before cultural ties were firmly established. They came with their military might and careful planning. After achieving several goals, in 1850, Britain decided it was time to target the people's culture and languages.
The first thing the British did was to ban Persian, the teaching of Persian, in areas under their control. Of course, there are so many other states which are not directly under the control of the British. Like we had Hyderabad, we had Bhopal, we had some other small principalities which were having the local rule, not directly under the British, although the external affairs were in the hands of the British. In these places, the Persian was there, but in the central places, I mean the central provinces, or the parts of India or Pakistan, what you call it now, which were under the direct rule of the British, here they banned the use of Persian language, and first they encouraged Urdu, and then they replaced it with English. Because as I said, it was easier for them to rule India, because once the English language became dominant, they can rule the people, they can divide them further. And it was in these times, more divisions happened in it, because of the difference of languages. As long as the people used to follow the Persian language, they were united.
After the collapse of Muslim power, Britishers came here. They replaced the language, official language, with English. And the madrasa institutions were compelled by the system to introduce Hindi and English in their courses. So due to these changes, political changes, the importance of Persian language was minimized. This was a political change. Due to that political change, that Persian language could not be retained as the official language or the language more than important more than other languages. So it was only due to the political reasons.
It's because of the English or the British control over India in the 19th century, and how gradually the British, they seized all parts of India. And when they found that the cultural links between the Iranians and the Indians were quite deep, they wanted to, as part of the policy of divide and rule, they wanted to separate the two peoples so that it would be easier for them to separate them, rule them. So I think that's one of the reasons, as you said, as you pointed out, that for the time being, the relations in the political sphere, we have only to do with the oil, the purchase of oil from Iran, and this exchange of students, because there are so many students studying in India because of the technology and the language that the Indians have. There are so many Iranians going to the Indian universities,
and studying over there. And there are so many other items as well, because if you look at the carpet trade, because even the carpets in Kashmir, they have been influenced by the Iranian carpets. And there are so many other factors we can discuss and elaborate upon in the course of time.
By attacking India's ancient culture and the Persian language, Britain became an alien entity in the eyes of the people. I myself am curious as to how the Persian language and culture managed to affect every aspect of India, only via culture. To write poetry and invite the people to love and friendship, while the British onslaught was so determined to separate them from those things. What a difference.
When India became, this Indo-Pakistan subcontinent became a colony of the Britishers. And one of the very important things for them was not only occupy it for political gains, but to transform it culturally and delink its people with their rich past. So that was initiated by the Britishers. So they changed their law, which was Islamic jurisprudential law, which was here in this whole subcontinent, and they just, language is one of the targets of the colonial powers. And so they wanted to delink the people with their rich cultural past, and one of them was replacing the language. Though Urdu is a cultural continuation of Persian, and Urdu after 1947, particularly, it was in a way ostracized and marginalized, being described as a communal language. So the people in India, they were bereft of this very rich language, rich legacy. And when the people are bereft of their legacies, cultural legacies, they are subject to manipulations.
It's quite contrary to what the relations they had with British. British came here as an power of occupied powers. They didn't treat this as their own country. They wanted India for some reasons, and they used it for some reasons. But for those who came from the immediate West, whether from Iran or they adopted India. Even the kings who came, even the Mughals came, or whoever came from that, the Central Asia or these parts, they made it their own country. They came here, they lived here, and they had relations with the locals. They adopted it their own country, and they treated it as their own country. I don't think that anybody in India now, you heard that they will tell you that the Mughals came from outside. They treat them as their own kings. They treated them their own. They treated them their own rulers. So this is not the case with the British. So these two rules, these two periods had entirely different dynamics. When the people from, there had been continuous migrations for centuries from Iran to this part of the world. You see the lots of Indians who claimed themselves as an Iranian descent. So they lived here, they made it their home, and they are as happy as anything.
It's because of this that the Indian culture is still brimming with elements of the Persian language, unaffected by colonialism and politics. Books, inscriptions, society, the spoken languages of India all display Persian influences and all speak of love, friendship, God, and life. They hearken back to a time when Persian had prominence.
It's very essential to know that because earlier, the Farsi was the court language also, and all the documents, even in the during the British period, were written in Farsi. So that has to be, it was a subject which one has to know. The sale deeds and the property papers, the documents, they were all in Farsi. It is only later that Urdu replaced it, and thereafter other languages, English and Hindi and other languages.
So far as I know about the relationship of India and Iran, these relationship is of, I think, cordial relationship, because give and take relationship. The impact of Iranian language, because the Mughals were the rulers for many years, they used Iranian language in their judicial language or in their court language it was, and various poets such as, you can say, Saadi or Rumi, and generally people considered that Rumi is their mentor, his spiritual mentor, as Allama Iqbal, the one of the most, what you can say, important poet philosopher of Indian subcontinent.
The imagination of the men and women of this land still takes to its wings at the sight of the poems of great poets such as Saadi, Hafiz, Jami, and Maulavi. They take a trip down memory lane and remember the good times for India. And the young in this vast country, just like their ancestors, consider Farsi as a window to their history and the time when the Persian language was in widespread use. Today, poetry in India is not only an arrangement of rhyming words, but also a statement speaking of the culture, relation, and the life of the Eastern man, and on top of it all, the human relations between the two nations. I leave India firm in the notion that this great country, with all its beauty, its warm-hearted people and history, owes some of its success to the Persian language. India's libraries, architecture, and its elderly bear witness to that. And finally, I'm reminded of a line from the poet Iqbal Lahori that represents the deep-rooted cultural relations between the nations of the region and the role of the Persian language in making that bond stronger. A poem that would probably lose its meaning in translation if rendered into English. Like a lantern, I burn on your street. Oh, the youth of Persia, believe me, I have spent a big part of my life thinking, until I came to understand your hidden thoughts.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the member you are listening to. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
Tonight, inshallah, I want to speak a little bit about the Holy Prophet. Who is the one that knows him the best? None other than Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam. So there's no doubt that one place at least that we can go to learn about the Holy Prophet is to Ali ibn Abi Talib. Three things I want to talk about, inshallah, from Nahj al-Balagha. The Prophet's origins in Nahj al-Balagha. In Farsi, we have a saying, Sali kenikust as baharash peydast. Yes, you can tell the year is going to be a good year from the spring. If the spring is good, it's just a Farsi saying. It might not always be true because COVID taught us otherwise, right? But you can tell a year is good from the beginning of it, the way things start, right? So the origins of the Holy Prophet. When you look at the origins of the Holy Prophet, you're like, okay, you can tell there's something special going on. But Ali tells us of those origins. That's one thing we want to talk about. All right, let's go. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The Prophet's origins in Nahj al-Balagha. Sermon number 94. فاستودعهم في أفضل مستودع وأقرهم في خير مستقر. The Imam, he says, Allah kept the prophets in deposit, in the best place of deposit, before they were born, or when they were being born, and made them stay in the best place of stay. He moved them in succession from distinguished forefathers to chaste wombs. I'll talk about this later. Whenever a predecessor from among them died, the follower, the one that came after, the one who succeeded, stood up for the cause of the religion of Allah. Okay, so he's talking about the prophets in general, correct? So this applies to our prophet too, yes, but then he makes it a point to speak about the prophet in particular. Ali makes a point. He goes on, Hatta afdat karamatullah subhanahu ila Muhammadin sallallahu alayhi wa alihi fa akhrajahu min afdalil ma'adini manbitan وَأَعَزِّ الْأُرُمَاتِ مَغْرِسًا. And he goes on. Until this distinction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the glorified, reached Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi and his descendants, Allah brought him out from the most distinguished sources of origin and the most honorable places of planting. Planting, you plant a seed?
Yeah.
Sometimes you can plant a seed in a fertile ground, sometimes in a barren ground. I've seen it. In the land of Shamat and in Lebanon and Syria and those places, if you go, you'll see some places that the dirt and soil is like almost black. That's how rich it is. Anything you plant in there, even if you stand there for 5 minutes, something's going to probably grow out of you. You know, that's how fertile it is. And then there are some places like where we're living, or even worse, other places where no matter what you do, you can't grow a single plant, right? Here, he actually says a planting area to really illustrate for us that Allah is actually doing some work here, planting something and trying to yield fruit and result from it. All right, so he says, the most honorable places of planting, namely from the same lineal tree from which he brought forth other prophets. Now we know why he called it the planting, because there's a tree, a lineage that goes back to who? Goes back to previous prophets. From which he selected his trustees. Muhammad's descendants are the best descendants, his kinsmen the best of kin, and his lineal tree the best of trees. It grew in esteem and rose in distinction. It has tall branches and unreachable fruits. Yeah. If you've gone to these orchards, sometimes you're picking the fruit, you see those big fat cherries at the top. They're big fat cherries at the top because no one else could reach them. You can't either. That's why they're still there intact. Right? These descendants of the Holy Prophet, also they're the fruit. Imam Ali Nahjul Balagha, he refers to himself as the fruit of the tree. You know when? Saqifa. When they said that the first and second Khalifa are from Quraysh and that the bay'ah should be given to them, they argued with what? With the tree of Quraysh. What does Imam Ali say? He says, اِحْتَجُّ بِالْشَجَرَ وَأَضَاعُ الثَّمَرَ. They argued with the tree. They made an argument with the tree, which is Quraysh. But wait a minute. There is a fruit at the top of this tree that you all cannot reach. And that is at the thamara of this tree, which was the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. And so, adaa'u al-thamara. They forgot the fruit of the tree. They lost the fruit of the tree. Yes, there is a tree with fruit. And this fruit is not attainable for everybody. I can't say like, I want to be one of those fruits. No. These are unreachable fruits. Unreachable, I would say, in the sense of you can't be one of them. You can make the most of that fruit, but you can't be one of them. It's unattainable. Isma and infallibility, in that sense, we believe, is something that Allah blesses certain individuals with. So here the Imam is making a point that yes, the family tree, the lineage plays a role. Does it play the entire role? Well, let me make that disclaimer right now. No, it doesn't. You know why? What's the best example of a Hashemite who is going to be in Jahannam for sure? Because the Quran said so. Who's that? Abu Lahab. The uncle of the Prophet. Uncle of the Prophet. Brother of Abdullah. Brother of Abbas. This individual is a Hashemite. He's from the Bani Hashim. Did being from the Bani Hashim help him? No. Why? Because the Quran said so. Tabbat yada abi. I mean, if you're going to have a surah of the Quran named after you, make sure it's in a positive way, not in a negative one, you know? Hey, people, my name's in the Quran. Yeah, but look what it's saying about you. Tabbat yada abi lahabin wa tab. May your hands be cut. And your wife. Both of y'all going to hell. So lineage doesn't always play a role, but for sure it's part of the reason why people like this, you will not have a tree of mushrikeen, and then all of a sudden a prophet emerged. We're not saying that everyone's going to go to Jahannam if they come from a certain tree. Let's get this right. But those chosen elite individuals that are going to be prophets, usually, if not always, let me correct that, always when you look at the tree, you will find they come from a tree of Tawheed, to the point that mainstream Shia believes that when Prophet Ibrahim in the Quran says, "My father, oh Allah, forgive my father for his shirk," that wasn't his actual biological father. That was the man that raised him. But it wasn't his actual biological father. Yes, so this is a mainstream Shia belief that yes, if you want one of these awliyaullah, they will come as a result of that tree. But yes, lineage will not do all the work for you. قَالَ وَمِن دُرِّيَّتِي قَالَ لَا يَنَالُ عَهْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ Prophet Ibrahim, in the Quran, when he is made an imam after he was already prophet for God knows how long, he sees how awesome this position is of imamah that he has now. He says, "Oh Allah, for my descendants, I wish this for my descendants. لَا يَنَالُ عَهْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ There are going to be some of your descendants who have committed sins in their life. It won't reach them. But they're my lineage. Lineage doesn't do all the work for you. But yes, you got to have that at least and other things. And so this is why they say that كُتِبَ لِلنَّبِيِّ عَلَيْهِ الصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ 500 أُمَّنْ فَمَا وُجِدَتْ فِيهِنَّ سِفَاحًا وَلَا شَيْئًا مِمَّا كَانَ مِنْ أَمْرِ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ That they wrote down the ancestors of the Holy Prophet from his mother's side all the way up. And here it says 500. I'm guessing it's just, you know, to show that as many as there were, they looked through all of these names, they did not find one unchaste woman amongst these women. And anything of jahiliyyah that would taint a woman back then, they didn't find any signs of that. So these are his origins, brothers and sisters, according to Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matim شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
The listener, Siddiqa, is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. All right, Siddiqa, in our previous session, we have been talking about OCD in general, and then you differentiated that with doubts, and you came up with some examples which had light on the topic, giving religious examples, like you said, anti-religious thoughts coming into the mind. It's okay, it's not a sin. One should not feel regretful, but at the same time, one needs to go and seek help. And you also talked about some of the methods to overcome this disorder. Now, there are also seen some eating disorders. Can we also call that or get it into the category of OCD?
Some in the medical field put eating disorders as part of OCD. And again, eating disorders are seen as a result of extreme pressures or extreme trauma that people go through. And eating disorders are largely seen in women. Now, there could be many reasons for it. And mainly, it could be that women tend to cope in different ways than men. So some women might cope with their daily pressures or whatever trauma they've been through by eating. Bulimia is a form of eating disorder, right? So basically a person would eat, would first try to restrict the food,
mm-hmm.
right? And then they would start eating and then trying to throw it out. And this can have eating disorders, even though externally it just seems a person is controlling the eating. There are a lot of mental issues that a person goes through when they're going through these eating disorders. And this eating disorders in women can have different categories. Some would refrain from eating only a specific type of food. Like, for example, they would refuse to eat only dairy products.
Okay.
Right? Not because they see anything wrong with it or because they're vegans or any of that sort. It's just that it is a form of a coping mechanism that they've entailed, that they've stuck to now.
Okay.
Now, given that dairy products and these products do give them vitamins, or if they end up eating these, then they would try and throw it out, which then again comes through not only externally harming the body, but then mentally harming themselves as well, because they see themselves as having done something wrong by eating, for example, milk or drinking milk.
Okay.
So again, because it is so common in women, eating disorders are common in women. Now, why are eating disorders common in women is another issue.
So you are trying to say, even if you're not allergic to some food, you're just trying to avoid it?
As a coping mechanism.
Okay.
As a coping mechanism over here. Not because of any specific reason. Yes. It's just to cope with the trauma.
And you see that a lot in women.
Eating disorders generally come about in women a lot more than they do in men. Why women would choose food to cope? It could be because of their self-image, self-esteem, how they view themselves. You know, unfortunately, in the world today, we have a lot of issues such as fat shaming. So if a woman is just a tiny size bigger, she is shamed in the size of her body. And then, especially when it comes to teenage girls, when they're going through schools and they go through peer pressure and societal pressures, their self-esteem is reduced just on the basis of how they look. And this could lead to trauma because they are bullied. And that one form of coping with that bullying goes to eating disorders. And these disorders then extend into their adult life, and it affects how they view their relationship, because they're constantly trying to make themselves feel better through food. And that's not the way to make a person feel better.
All right. Just in order to have a better body image, you try to avoid a lot of foods.
Not only to have a better body image. It could be a cause of why women are so susceptible to eating disorders.
Okay.
It's not only to look better. It could be a cause of why women start to portray OCD in eating.
In eating, okay.
Just because probably they're bullied, or because today we have such very absurd expectations of how a woman should look.
Look like, exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady and I'm with Sadiqa. We're talking on different forms of OCD and right now we're focusing on what kind of OCDs women go through.
Yeah. In the previous episodes, we discussed intrusive thoughts. Then we discussed eating disorders. Now, another one that is more common and is women are affected, men are affected by it. It is the compulsion to constantly renew the wudu, for example, within Islamic world, or constantly pray. They'll start the prayer and then they'll think that they've made a mistake. This is, I'm giving Islamic examples.
Okay.
But it comes under OCD where the need to repeat an action several times. Now, I've seen this in women, right? So I was in the masjid once and there was a woman standing next to me. It was congregation prayers. And one phrase, she repeated it 3-4 times. And I started getting frustrated because I was like, calm down. And that made me realize she's going through a much more worse state in her
situation,
life.
Situation, yeah.
Because now she's having to compulsively repeat that phrase so much that she cannot go into her next action in her prayer because there's a thought in her head that's telling her, if you do not do it correctly, then this will happen. It's very compulsive and women go through this quite a bit. So again, when it comes to Islamic ruling on this, Islam gives a general directive to this.
So we have a ruling over this.
We already have a ruling. Ignore it. The best way to ignore these, to handle these issues is to ignore it. There's this obsessive thought in my head. You need to redo your wudu, right? Ablution. Ignore it. Islam says ignore it to the extent that the jurists have said, I am giving you an order that you do not need to repeat it. And if you do repeat it, who are you repeating it for? You're repeating for yourself. You're not repeating it for Allah, right? So if you constantly tell yourself, look, Allah has given me a directive, only one wudu for namaz and that's it. No 2, 3, 4, 5. I know of people who have said they have repeated their prayer 7 times.
Because it does not sound very attractive to them.
Yes, one of that, but they feel that they've made a mistake.
Yeah.
Right? I
it does not sound very perfect, very attractive. They feel like they've done mistakes.
It's just a thought that comes in their head which tells them you've done wrong, even though they've not done wrong. And Islam completely comes, and over here Islam gives a blanket ruling. In other cases, Islam doesn't give a blanket ruling. But over here, because of the severity of the effect on a person's life, Islam gives a blanket ruling and says, ignore it. I'd gone once to my teacher about this issue, and it was in relation to a woman who I know, and she was going through this very difficult stage where it would take her 1 hour to pray one namaz. So I'd gone to my teacher, who's again teaching jurisprudence, and I told her that, look, this woman is going through a very difficult stage, and she's taking 1 hour to pray one namaz. And she told me, look, in this case, she should pray in whatever way she can. Like, even if she's not reciting anything, it doesn't matter. Just pray in whatever way you can. And Islam comes about and says, if you can, in these issues, if you cannot pray individually at home, then go for congregational prayers.
Well, we have very kind nature of Islam over here to just help us come over the mental state we're going through.
Yeah.
We'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm with Sadiqa and we're discussing OCD. And now we're focusing on the examples related to women. the conditions of OCD that women go through. Yes, Sadiqa.
Another OCD that women generally see, which is very common about women, is excessive cleaning and hand washing. This might seem as not very harmful, but I again have seen people who've developed extreme forms of eczema because of the amount of liquids and detergents they've used to clean their hands. So again, externally, we might not think it's harmful for them, but because of the mental health and then the later consequences of constant hand washing that they bring about, this is where the harm comes.
Okay.
Right? And the different ways of dealing with these forms of OCD. Now, I'm going to give just a few methods of dealing with it. One is meeting a psychologist or a counselor, and I recommend an Islamic counselor, especially if those OCD is religious-based or if you're having obsessive religious thoughts. Use the word Allah, because the word Allah itself is Isma Azam. It's one of the best names of Allah, and it brings intense peace to a person's heart.
It does.
The other forms are reciting salawat constantly through the day. So I know of scholars...
And we also have this verse from Surah Ra'ad, which says that it's the zikrullah. It's a,
yes. Allah bi zikrullah tatma'innul qulub.
That provides peace to the heart.
Yeah. So some scholars have said reciting salawat, for example, 1,001 times a day. And because salawat is one of the adhkar, one of the dhikrs, one of those things that they have positive consequences.
Yeah.
So they've said about reciting about 1,000 times a day, 1,001 times. Now, obviously, not everyone can do 1,000 times, but dividing it over the day, like, for example, 100 times after every salah or 200 times after every salah. Others have said reciting astaghfar, because astaghfar removes bala from a person's life. It removes tribulations from a person's life.
It's a kind of shower to your soul.
Exactly. So now, this reciting astaghfar does not mean OCD is a sin. It's just that astaghfar, astaghfirullah rabbi wa atubu ilay. And some have said, again, reciting it 1,000 times a day.
All right.
And they say it because astaghfar generally removes all sorts of tribulations from a person's life. And OCD is a form of tribulation, right?
It is.
Yes. So some scholars have said reciting that. And then just generally getting into, if it's religious-based thoughts, then allowing yourself to read books and help yourself acquaint better with religion. So turning a negative into a positive. So if you're having negative religious thoughts, now turning into a positive and reading about it to, you know, increase. Education is a source of pleasure for the soul. So again, turning a negative into a positive. And one scholar interestingly said to have a bath with cedar water.
All right.
There's a specific leaf called cedar.
Yeah.
I don't have the English equivalent, but it's easily...
is also used for the
shrouding of the body. When they do ghusl of the body, they use this specific leaf that they put it in water. And they say because it calms the head down, they say just putting some cedar water on the head to calm that person down. So there are different injunctions, but obviously... getting the correct help from a psychologist should be taken into account because they have very good methods. And the last and the final method is when a person is going through these doubts, and Islam talks about this as well, ignore it, even if it's thoughts. Generally, slowly and gradually, just get it out of your head. Do not think about it. And if there are any doubts with your hand washing, wudu, namaz, ignore it and get on with life. It becomes easier.
It becomes easier. Thank you so much for coming up with all those solutions. You reminded me of when I was doing contemplation of Surah Nas in my class, and our teacher would tell us that recite Surah Nas every 20 minutes because you are constantly seeking refuge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from all the evils of mankind, from all the evils, from jinn, from every creation. You're actually seeking refuge to Allah. So once you're seeking refuge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's no danger that's going to harm you, be that your mental health, be that your physical health. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11, or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about
whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted. This was unjust. This was horrible. And we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region. And indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations.